Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
My name is Jo Bartosz, and in this mini-series, I'll be speaking with the people who made the Cast Review happen. The publication of the Cast Review in April has provoked a reckoning about how best to treat children who identify as trans, and it's exposed a medical scandal at the heart of the National Health Service. But the Cast Review itself would not have been commissioned at all were it not for the work of brave academics, clinicians, lawyers, politicians and campaigners. Today I am joined by Stephanie Davies-Arai of the group Transgender Trend. So Stephanie has been sounding the alarm about the impact of trans ideology on children for a decade now. And I think it's fair to say that the Cast Review would not have happened had it not have been for her work in founding Transgender Trend, which is an organisation of parents and professionals and academics who are alarmed by the sudden rise in young women adopting trans identities. Since the organisation was founded, she's really been a thorn in the side of child transition charities like Mermaids, and she's consistently looked for evidence about how to support children. And prior to becoming both a reviled and adored as an evil transphobe, Stephanie advised on parenting, and she wrote a book called Communicating with Kids. And she was also one of the campaigners who was instrumental in getting Page 3 banned. So welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, Jo.
And if I could just sort of kick off and first ask, when did you notice that there was such a rise in children identifying as trans? Was there anything in particular that tipped you off?
No one thing, no. It happened quite gradually over probably 2013, 2014. And I was noticing things as a member of the No More Page 3 campaign, actually. Things about women-only meetings, or being trans inclusive, and the word cis coming in. And I was worried about those things. And I was the one member of the campaign team who raised concerns about those sorts of things. But regarding children, it was articles in, it was mostly the tabloids like The Mirror and The Sun started to publish stories about little children transitioning. So that didn't come as a huge surprise, because I'd already known that the trans thing was starting to happen. But I was so shocked by it, because these were always stories about very young children, and they were stories of children transitioning in schools, and there wasn't any comeback, really, nobody questioning it. And so I started researching. In the job that I was doing, I was following a lot of parenting coaches and posting my blogs on parenting websites. So I looked at child mental health charities. I mean, I looked all over for anybody who was talking about it, and nobody was. And that was really unusual, because if there's ever a new thing in childhood, or new understanding of childhood development, or a new approach to children, then it would be hotly debated and people would disagree. And I didn't see any of that. Everywhere I looked was a complete acceptance that if a little boy said, "I'm a girl," then you should affirm him as a girl. And that I knew immediately that was wrong and completely unique in any kind of parenting advice that I'd ever read. So it really stuck out. But the biggest thing was that there was silence on it. It landed as a done deal with no question and no debate.
And sort of vaguely, what sort of year was that you started to notice?
That was, I would say that the articles in mainstream newspapers were certainly happening in 2014, probably 2013. I can't remember exactly when I saw the first one.
And when did you realise that it was up to you And that nobody else was really doing anything about it.
Well, it was after, searching for any child development expert or child safeguarding expert, or, anybody, total parenting coach, when I saw that nobody else was talking about it. And I was writing a weekly parenting blog at the time, and I increasingly felt that this was something that I should talk about. But I'd already, of course, I'd understood the message that this is something we can't talk about. And so I was really scared. I was afraid that if I wrote anything on my parenting blog, then I may lose followers. And also it was sort of too political, or it felt a scary area to go into. But I thought I have a responsibility, because I work with parents, I run and te teachers, I run teacher training courses, parent courses. I work with parents one to one. I hear every problem, and so if I can't talk about this, then that's a real abnegation of my responsibility. So the first blog post I wrote on my Communicating with Kids blog was in early 2015, and it got a huge reaction. And I don't think I was really surprised, actually. I think I understood that there would be some parents who would be relieved to hear something different about this subject that nobody else was questioning.
And when did you sort of turn your attention to the JIDs and to what was happening at the Tavistock?
So I think that again came up quite gradually. I began to think, well, I need to set up a separate website, which I felt at that time it would be connected to my Communicating with Kids website. And I began to gather any information, any research studies, any hard evidence that I could find about this subject and about medical transition. So I found the Dutch study, and I found various things. And so the more I read, the more I became really concerned about what was happening to children medically. And I realized, and this was in 2015, over that year, I was gathering together resources for the website, which I saw as a resource for parents, where they could find evidence-based research and information and analysis of what was happening in one place, rather than all the ideological information they could find from lobby groups like Mermaids and Stonewall. But in 2015, it was in August, I think, it was the Women and Equalities Committee Transgender Equality Inquiry. And I submitted a response to that, which was quite rushed, actually. Then you just made the deadline, because I realised I was off to a festival for the weekend and realised that I hadn't done my submission yet. So it was quite rushed, but I did submit a response to that, and a few women did. Very few people knew about it, but a few women did, and none of us were invited to give oral evidence. I think it was at that point I understood really what was happening at the Tavistock specifically, because there was a response to the inquiry from the Tavistock and from Mermaids and Bernadette Wren, Susie Green, Mermaids, Gendered Intelligence were there. The trans activists were invited in to give oral evidence, whereas women weren't. And so I understood the connection between the lobby groups and the clinic. And I thought that if there were groups like Mermaids that seemed to have a very close connection with the Tavistock, then I needed to set up an organisation that would also have a relationship with the Tavistock, because why not? They were clearly influenced by the parents who believed in the concept of the transgender child and were an influence on them as a patient group. But also I felt it would be good to have an organisation coming from the other direction, which was about caution and about allowing children to be gender non-conforming or allowing them to grow up. I already knew that most of these kids would turn out to be gay as adults, and I think that's the direction I was coming from, actually. More at that time, it wasn't so much the autistic teenagers or the rapid onset group. It really was the little children and the research we had on little children, which showed that most of them came to terms with their biological sex during or by the end of puberty and became gay or lesbian as adults. So so I thought, right, I will be another organisation that will have a relationship with the Tavistock and be an influence on the Tavistock. And I went to the first conference, I think it was in 2016, 2017, which was called Hot Topics in Child Health. And that was when I first met Polly Carmichael and Bernadette Wren. Oh no, I met Bernadette Wren before, actually. I went to a seminar in Cambridge and met Bernadette Wren there, but Sarah Davidson, and they were very welcoming to me and said my work was it was really important. And they read my blog posts and said, keep doing what you're doing, and very, very friendly. And my feeling then was that I would be a sort of critical friend, that I would build a relationship. And because that conference was organized by the Tavistock in conjunction with Mermaids and GIRES, the Gender Identity Research and Education Society. And in fact, Terry Lane Terry from GIRES gave a presentation at that conference. So again, I could see the strong connection between these groups, and I thought, so if I'm an organisation that has a good relationship with the Tavistock, I will be invited to a conference to speak. And that didn't happen. There was another Tavistock conference that I went to where there was gendered intelligence, all sorts, I think the Intercom Trust, and various trans activist lobby groups were presenting at this conference, which seemed to be a conference where they all presented their business models. But Transgender Trend wasn't invited to present at that conference. I went along to it, but so it never actually happened that we had the same influence as the trans groups did.
That must have been incredibly isolating. Who did you turn to for support? What sort of other organisations were in existence at the time? Were there sort of organisations elsewhere in the world? How did you? I mean, it must have felt a little bit like you were
Well,
going mad.
there was Fourth Wave Now in the States, and Denise from Fourth Wave Now contacted me as soon as my blog came out on my parenting website, and it was called Is My Child Transgender? And some, you know, it was a small website. It didn't have that many followers on that blog, and I don't know how she found it, but she was desperate for other, you know, to find other people who were speaking out. So she contacted me straight away, and we did an interview for Fourth Wave Now. And then she put me together on a list of, she had it like an email list with parents from mostly the US and Canada. And that was very important, actually, because I learned a lot from those parents about the distress that they were going through and how it impacted on families. So there was Denise, who's remained a good friend all of these years. She was really somebody to turn to when I felt overwhelmed or upset, you know, the sort of the bullying that I had. And then my sister, Helen Saxby, she was there, you know, she was somebody that was there right from the start. I think that in retrospect, this is really important to have somebody to talk to, because one of the things that keeps people silent is thinking that they're the only person in the world who has concerns about this. And the message is put out, everyone just agrees with this. There's no question about it. All all right people, just accept and agree with this. It's clearly right. And so you don't want to speak out because you don't want to be that one evil person who, the only one. And so having somebody there right at the start that I could, Helen and I were sending each other, emailing each other articles we found, we were discussing it whenever we met up. And so it's important to be able to talk through things because I think when you talk about, you talk through your ideas or your views and then you process them and you develop them. Talking is really important, and that's something that was really lacking. Women couldn't talk about it. You didn't dare risk saying anything to anybody in case they thought you were an evil bigot. And so that was really important. And I had, it was a few, in 2015, I met a group of lesbians. It was after the
Oh, yeah.
Philia conference in London. It was Sheila Jeffries, Leanne Timmerman, Angela C. Wilde, who I didn't know at all at the time. I already knew Julia Long because we'd done a conference together a year or so beforehand. And we got together in an email group. So they were all backing me in making this website and organization. That was really important. And then there was a Facebook group, and that came from Mumsnet. And Mumsnet had a real instrumental role in being one place where you could talk about these issues, even though you had to be careful. And in the early days, there was a lot of, there was some anger about Mumsnet not publishing comments or even banning people, I think. But they settled down and they were very brave, actually. It's remained a platform where women can talk about these issues fairly openly and honestly. And from Mumsnet, a sort of secret Facebook group was set up.
I think that's where we
So there
met.
was that. So the
Yeah.
various fans, the people who I knew were supporting me, who I knew thought these issues were important. It was just that out in the real world or out in the public world was silence.
Thank you. That's it's quite good to be reminded of how bloody tough it was to voice these opinions. Well, basic facts, really. I mean, would you mind sort of talking a little bit perhaps about the pressure that you had about, because I know that you've been smeared by Pink News, by obviously mermaids, by trans activists all over the place. And I know Stonewall in particular issued warning against some guidance that that Transgender Trend put out. And somewhat ironically, it's perfectly, I mean, it was years before, but it's almost exactly the same as the government guidance now that's just been issued, which is obviously accepted as sort of fairly mainstream. So what did you face, and did it make you doubt yourself?
Oh, of course, especially Stonewall. So I put out the school's guidance and I wrote the school's guidance because that was what parents were saying. What we need is school's guidance. And I do think that if you've got really bad guidance in your child's school, it's one thing to say, to go, talk to the head and say, I disagree with this guidance. It's quite another if you've got an alternative guidance in your hand and to say, read this instead. It's hugely, it's really empowering. I always think, if there's a problem, find an alternative. Don't just complain about the problem. So I spent I think most of 2017 working on the school's guidance and wanted to publish it at the time because the Equality and Human Rights Commission was supposed to be publishing their school's guidance in March 2018. So I got mine in February, and I'd already become a stakeholder in the EHRC schools guidance, because up to that point they're only stakeholders. They had a round table with Stonewall, Mermaids, Gendered Intelligence, Gyres, all sorts. So I contacted them and asked to be a stakeholder, and again had no influence. even though I, you know, I emailed them, I sent them schools guidance. And we published four schools guides altogether on different issues, but I sent them to the EHRC, and then eventually, years later, when they did produce their draft guidance, they'd take none of that into account. I also emailed them with parent concerns about what was happening in their child's school. But anyway, when I in 2018, so I published it, and then I did a crowdfunder to get it printed, to make printed copies, and that's when it really kicked off. They there was a campaign to stop the crowdfunder because I was publishing something that was hate, and it was suspended for 6 days while crowdfunder had a look at it with their lawyers to see if there was any hate in it. And that was incredibly, so that was the first time really that I thought, well, I might as well give up now, because if who knows what crowdfunder will find? They may interpret anything from that school's guide as hate if they want to, as the trans activists had done. So I didn't know which way that would go, and I think it was saved by a phone call that I had. And so I kept calling crowdfunder, and I spoke to somebody who's just about to go into a meeting to discuss it, and I think they'd actually made up their minds to stop the crowdfunder. And I do think that after talking to me, she realised that I wasn't a sort of far
Crazy
right
bigot.
bigot, yeah, and that I was a reasonable person. And I'm sure that made a big difference, that phone call. Anyway, it still took 6 days, and 6 days during which I really couldn't function. I was really thinking, this is it, you know. If they say they're not going to, we can't use their platform because this is publishing hate, then we're finished. But they didn't. They couldn't find any hate, and went ahead with the crowdfunder. But Stonewall published a statement saying that the school's guide was deeply damaging and against the Equality Act. Mermaids published a statement with oh, somebody else too, and that's when the real vicious bullying started online. And I think because, again, I thought, if Stonewall can publish schools guidance, and these other Intercom Trust have published schools guidance, all sorts of published schools guidance, then why not me? I'm actually more qualified than them to write schools guidance about children, because their guidance wasn't based on children at all. There's no understanding of child development or no experience working in schools. I'd worked in a primary school for 8 years. I worked with parents and teachers. I knew the subject. I was more qualified than them to produce a school's guide. And I thought, if they can do it, really anybody can. So that was the first time. But I think the most difficult time for me, there have been a few occasions, but the biggest one really was when I wrote a letter. I'd been asked by the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy to write, or I was interviewed, the editor of their in-house magazine, Therapy Today, came round to my house and interviewed me for an article about the approach towards these children. And one side was the affirmation side, and the other side was the caution. So there was me, there was James Caspian, and Bob Withers were interviewed for one side of the debate. And some activists were interviewed for the other side. And then I got an email saying, actually, our side had been cut. And the article was published, which was promoting only affirmation. So I wrote a letter to Therapy Today, sort of complaining about that. It was published, and the editor, who was the one who'd interviewed me, published it and thanked me for it. And then all hell broke loose. And I think a petition was started, and it ended up with Therapy Today issuing an apology and a statement which sort of implied that I supported conversion therapy. It was, we don't agree with the values of transgender trend. And they just signed the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding on conversion therapy, which had added gender identity. So
What's this from?
I mean, I spent I wrote to BACP, I wrote to and Stonewall, I wrote to, it was who was it at the time? Was it Ruth Hunt? And Hannah Kilbride, who'd written the article, and asking for a right of reply, asking for them all to all for them to apologize for the statement they made, and wrote to BACP, nothing. So that, but when that statement came out on the BACP website, I really did think that was the end, because I thought this, Stonewall is one thing, they're a lobby group. BACP are a counselling body, a professional body. And if they've judged me, and it was my second letter that had been published in Therapy Today. I'd had a letter published there previously after going to one of their conferences. So it was, I felt I'm never going to be able to get over this, that they will be able to use this constantly. British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy have said this, I think I was at least a week of thinking that I should give up now. This is too big for me. I'm one person here, and this is, the forces against me are too big.
Would you mind just explaining, because I don't think everyone will necessarily be aware of the memorandum of understanding that was released and is now slowly people are starting to withdraw their
Yes.
supportive and support, which is very pleasing. But would you mind giving a bit of an overview of what it's about, just for
So
listeners?
the Memorandum of Understanding on Conversion Therapy is a professional practice guide, essentially, for all of the counselling bodies. And just about all of them have signed it, and NHS England have signed it. And it was originally gay conversion therapy. So there wasn't any issue there that therapists could not do gay conversion therapy. In 2016, and this is one of the first things I worked on, they added gender identity to the Memorandum of Understanding. And so I wrote to everybody, all the groups that had signed the original and were getting together with a round table to discuss adding gender identity. I wrote to this Secretary of State for Health, to various other people, outlining concerns about putting gender identity into a conversion therapy bill, and particularly the risk of a kind of a new form of gay conversion therapy for the little children in particular. And I did hear later that had been read out at the round table, but the round table, where they all discussed it, included Stonewall. So I also heard anecdotally that there was the same sort of fear of anybody speaking out and saying, expressing those concerns about it. Nobody dared say anything in front of Stonewall. So it happened, it was added, and I think in 2017, officially added. And I'm really pleased to see UKCP, the UK Council of Psychotherapies, was instrumental in bringing that group together and making that happen. And they have now withdrawn as a signatory to the Memorandum of Understanding for exactly the reasons that I outlined in 2016, the risk to children. So that's really good to see. And I think the debates on a legal ban on conversion therapy that includes gender identity, some of the peers especially have made really fantastic speeches about this issue, and people do really understand it now, I think, that that there is a real risk to children and young people from having such a thing as a ban on conversion therapy of gender identity.
Thank you. And I'm kind of, you know, you mentioned there that peers have been speaking out, and it has now become sort of acceptable to dissent from the mainstream trans activist opinion. When did you first notice that your message was starting to get through, that you were starting to have an effect? What was your first sort of indication that, you know, perhaps we might win this?
It's happened in stages again. The first time was in 2017, and I'd done a sort of survey of newspaper content with, and actually it was a, I got I wrote in a big group of women from the Facebook page, and Nick Williams from Fair Play for Women agreed to collate all the information. We looked at all the newspapers over the past year and that, or 2 years, I can't remember, but their reporting on the subject of trans kids. And we looked at various aspects, whether the report had also included any comment from professionals, anybody from the Tavistock, whether it was based on gender stereotypes, also, you know. And so yeah, there was a big group of women, and each of them took a sort of 3 month period for one newspaper. And so Nick Williams put this together into, you know, she sort of crunched the numbers and did the stats. And we came out with this really quite detailed report. I mean, it's not sort of scientifically sound. We were amateurs doing it, but it was interesting, the results that we found, and you know, very biased towards cheerleading the idea of transgender children. And I noticed then that this was in early 2017, and the second half of 2017, suddenly there were many more journalists writing about it in the mainstream media. And in fact, that year, in between Christmas and New Year, I wrote a roundup of the year because I was so excited about how mainstream it had become with journalists writing. I know you were very, very early, Joe. But so I thought then, well, the tide is turning. So I've reached that point several times along the way. Keira Bell, you know, that judicial review, I think, was perhaps the defining
Yes.
moment where the world was introduced to what was really happening in these clinics to these children and young people. And the world was introduced to the term detransitioner. So that was it. That was enormous, and had absolute global impact. So that was in 2020, and that was another huge moment. And then when I read through the CAS final report, it was interesting when and it didn't feel like any triumph or anything, but I sort of read it through, and there's what, 388 pages. It's a lot of reading. It took me all day. And I think I didn't have this one moment of thinking, job done, but it gradually occurred to me throughout reading it. By the end, I just thought I was feeling more than thinking, oh, well, this is what I've been campaigning for. You know, can I stop now?
Thank you. Thank you. That's really interesting. I mean, something I'd sort of keep reflecting on is how the language has changed. So, you know, it's I was just sort of thinking when both of us sort of first became interested in this, there was no term gender critical. There was no term single sex spaces in common use. There was no, I do feel like there's something about the language being adopted and just being able to have that framework to articulate the bloody obvious has been kind of important, hasn't it?
Yes, it was very interesting when I started. I was sometimes I find myself, I read through old blogs, and I realize that when the BBC put out a documentary for 6 to 12 year olds called I Am Leo, about a girl transitioning, I had used the pronoun she in that blog, and I never would do that now. And I stopped doing that very quickly, actually, very early on. I just
Oh, you
stopped
mean?
using pronouns, but the wrong sex pronouns.
Oh, right. Okay. So
But
yeah.
it.
So she. So she. The I
So,
am Leo was a girl.
sorry, sorry, sorry. I used the pronoun he. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I did.
Yeah.
It's so confusing. So I would never do that now, but I did actually write on. I did a sort of Q&A when I set up the website, and I did an explanation about pronouns and explained that sometimes I would be using the correct sex pronouns in order for a story to make sense. And I didn't in that case. I use, but I also, because I'm very focused. It's very single issue. It's children, but children in terms of health and education. So it's a massive, massive subject actually. It includes language, it includes rights, it includes things outside school and childhood settings, sort of in facilities in public places, for example. So but I thought my subject is very, very vulnerable children. And I need to, well, I was. I need to be very sensitive about those children and young people, but I am anyway. But also, because I was the first, I knew that I couldn't sort of blunder in shouting child abuse in 2015. I had to win people round. I wanted people to read what I was writing. So I was very, very careful. With my language, and very careful not to say anything that would immediately make people think, well, she's just a bigot, and stop reading.
Yeah. That's thank you. That's interesting, and it resonates. I think I had a similar sort of softly to start with. Obviously the Cass Review has essentially vindicated what you've been saying for bloody years. But do you have any concerns about how it might be implemented? Well, because I mean, obviously trans activist groups still have a lot of institutional power, and there are still a lot of people who were sort of kicking against her recommendations, even within the NHS. So yeah, how do you think we're gonna make this happen?
It's so embedded now, it's so embedded throughout the NHS. There are so many activists and activist clinicians, doctors, therapists who really believe in gender identity ideology, which I think is like a new religion, and you really are not allowed to question it or oppose it or disagree with it in any way. And of course, that kind of strongly held faith doesn't need evidence. And this is why I think there's been, they've called for no debate. It's why the Tavistock didn't bother to collect data, because a faith actually doesn't need evidence. It's the definition of a faith. So there are so many now, so many professionals who work with children, educational psychologists, teachers. And so it's going to be very difficult. The most difficult thing, I think, is the schools who've been socially transitioning children, and how we're going to turn that around. Because I think what came across really strongly to me from reading the Cass final report was I just had a sense that behind it was her compassion and concern for the children who'd essentially been lied to all of
Yes.
this time. So people are saying the Cass report is dangerous. Children are, going, and the results of it, sort of banning puberty blockers as a ordinary treatment. It's not the Cass report that's created this situation for children. It's the lobby groups, the teachers, the professionals, who have essentially lied to them that, to girls, yes, you really are a boy, which is the first lie, But then also, you need this treatment. It's life-saving medical treatment. You're more likely to take your own life if you don't get this treatment. And that anybody who doesn't affirm you is a transphobic bigot. And those messages are so harmful for children who now see themselves completely disempowering. And so children who see themselves as real victims, who see everybody else as the enemy, and who think it's either transition or die. You know, this message has been created, and that's what we have to address, how children are talked to about this issue. But yes, I am very concerned that that ex Tavistock GIDS clinicians have set up a private clinic, Chapter Plus, and there are so many who I think we've seen it happen already that it's difficult to get the staff for the new gender hubs because it's such a contentious and toxic area that clinicians are afraid to work in it. They're also afraid that if they do their job properly, they'll be accused of conversion therapy. So who'd want to work in that area? And so we need to, and this needs to come from the top, needs to come from the NHS. They really need to get gender identity ideology out of the NHS completely. And by that, I mean, including posters of the gender-bred person in your local GP surgery or pride displays during Pride Month in hospitals, in children's hospitals, the flying of the progress flag. Get it all out of the NHS. Get language back to saying woman rather than uterus,
Just
have all.
feeder.
And get back to reality right across the whole of the NHS and show that these clinicians and therapists, that the NHS has their back in doing their job properly for these children.
Thank you. I mean, it's notable that Transgender Trend has always had a very, very laser-like focus on protecting children and looking at the evidence. But I guess what you've hinted at there is there is a much wider problem that needs to be addressed. I mean, what does winning look like for Transgender Trend? What at what point do you think you'll be able to wrap up and say, job done, we're okay?
Well, it's funny. When I set it up, and I called it Transgender Trend, and thought I'll finish when the trend finishes. I think we're seeing signs of that now, and I think we're seeing it not just in public policies changing, more public awareness, politicians much more aware, and this issue being much more of an election issue generally, but I think also amongst young people, and this is anecdotally, but the generation coming up behind this, I think we've had a generation that have been totally indoctrinated and brainwashed into this ideology, and they genuinely believe that being a boy or a girl is a matter of how you feel, and it's not a matter of biology, because they've been taught that in school, and that they've learned it online, and then it's been reinforced in schools as the truth. So we have a generation, and the generation coming up behind, anecdotally, what I'm hearing is they're absolutely sick of the mention of the word gender. They roll their eyes when the non-binary supply teacher comes in. These are adolescents, as they are laughing at it.
This is
And I think,
Generation Alpha, is it? Just sort
I'm not
of
sure
alpha
what they're called.
consumers.
I'm not sure. I lose track. But yes, I think so. One thing that happened with this movement, it's an adult rights social justice movement. It's global. To me, it's the first movement that has created a real global online social contagion. So this generation have been wedded to their smartphones, they've been picking up all of this information on, started off on Reddit and Tumblr and YouTube and now TikTok, and so social contagion has been able to spread very rapidly across the world. And so, and this is our really our first example of a global social contagion for adolescents. And so what the movement did, and I've said this before, but I've never known an adult rights movement that has targeted children so aggressively as this one has, and including the small, youngest children. And so what they've done is they've framed it as a youth movement. And I hear professionals all the time saying, well, we must listen to children because they understand far more about gender than we do. I think, yeah. And have you stopped to think where they're getting this information from? No, it isn't an organic youth movement, as goths and emos were. It is an adult creative movement that has been sold as a youth movement. And I've always felt the movement will, that was clever in a way, because young people have been flattered into thinking that they're very progressive with their beliefs about gender. And it's a way for, of course, for adolescents to separate and from the parents and their parents' values and beliefs, and a way to be non-conforming and rebellious. So it's perfect for teenagers. But the problem with it is that all teenage fads pass and they become old-fashioned. And I think that is starting to happen now, and that will take its time, but the movement will peter out because youth movements do. But there's an awful lot of collateral damage in its wake, and some children will be permanently affected by it for the rest of their lives, as other children, move on and start to become adults and start rejecting some of the things and the beliefs they had when they were teenagers. Some children will be left with the physical effects of it and the psychological effects for the rest of their lives. And I wonder actually about the psychological effects on the whole generation, because the whole generation has been brought up within this belief system. And I think it's been hugely psychologically damaging in ways that we don't yet know.
Absolutely. I think just that foundational beliefs, not to trust your eyes, not to trust your instinct, not to trust the reality in front of you, but to trust somebody else's interpretation of it, it's just so
Yeah,
destabilizing, isn't it?
to disrupt children's connection with reality and understanding of
Yeah.
reality. It really is pulling the rug out from under their feet.
So yeah, where do you think you might go with transgender trend? What do you think the next sort of the next issue that you need to concentrate on within sort of unraveling this ideology and getting it out? What where's your focus?
Okay, well, it really is focusing on the issue of social transition in schools. We've also been really concerned for years about the adult clinics and that young, older teenage and young adult group. And I think the it's another, this is an answer to what I've been asking for, is a CASTAR review of the adult clinics, because the huge increase in numbers to those clinics, and a large, majority under 25s, and as with the child clinics, it's majority girls within that. And so these older teens and young adults are going to irreversible treatments, hormones, and then surgeries, and particularly girls with double mastectomies, but boys as well. And I think it's going to be the next big scandal. It's sort of a bigger scandal when it's younger children, but I think it's just as much of a scandal of what's happening to the older teens and young adults. They're a vulnerable group. They're separating from parents, becoming, they're sort of stepping into adulthood.
Yeah.
This is a very vulnerable time, and so I think that, yes, the focus on that. Also, the focus on the conversion therapy. There's, and again, this has happened all over the world. Conversion therapies, legal conversion therapy bills have been put in place that include gender identity with no thought at all about what that means for children. And then there's looking at safeguarding and how that has failed, and how, because I think, generally, I'm not a huge fan of another new bit of legislation. I'd rather the systems in place were working properly, and they haven't been. And the case of Rachel Mead, for example, who has just been vindicated with Social Work England. And she, for posting Facebook posts, including posts from Women's Place UK, Fair Play for Women, Transgender Trend, she was reported for that. Now, she's a social worker that is thoughtful, considers safeguarding in telling these most vulnerable group of children. Or teaching them gender identity and using gender identity in place of sex and the safeguarding implications of that. This is what something that social workers should be very aware of and be thinking about. And so winning her case and the exemplary damages awarded against Social Work England is a huge case. Now, it's getting back to the reality of what we had before, and its systems already in place to safeguard children that should be working but are not working, that have been forgotten or ignored. Girl Guiding UK, for example, allowing boys to sleep with girls if they identify as girls. That's sort of, safeguarding 101. You don't do that. And yet, with this one issue, trans, it seems that everything that we know about child development, child psychology, child safeguarding goes out of the window for this in this one particular area. So I'm really concerned about looking at all the areas that have failed children and ensuring that we don't make those mistakes again. Now, the push for a public inquiry, I support, although public inquiry always takes time. It's usually done after the scandal is over. After the scandal is over, the scandal is still going on. Certainly, in terms of the social experiment on children, though the medical experiment may be ending, and so I support a public inquiry and would like to be involved in that. But that takes time. We need to change things right now. And it's very good to see that starting to happen. So the announcement today that Kemi Badenoch will tighten regulations for toilets in public spaces so that they will be male female. We need the same in schools. So there's a lot, and I see my work now as less. I think in the early days it was really about having the debate, insisting on having the debate, changing the narrative of that debate, and bringing public awareness to what was actually happening. More, and I think more now, my work is about it's sort of bit almost behind the scenes, or the kind of boring stuff of actually getting things changed in meaningful ways. So the updating of building regulations is a really meaningful policy change to protect particularly women and girls using public toilets. So it's those kind of changes that I want. And interestingly, what's changed over these years of it as I've been working, from facing really palpable hostility from government officials, civil servants, EHRC, I'm now being listened to, and I think it's been plodding work, actually most of it, not giving up, and establishing a voice that is now respected and listened to. So it's using our position to influence how this goes. And then, yeah, I'll stop when it's done.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and thank you so much for your work and your bravery and your tenacity, because I know it's been bloody tough. So thank you.
You and there's been a lot of people who have been working really hard as well.